Hi, everybody. Welcome to Two Out the First. It's April the 12th, 2023. I'm Ryan Ballingy. It's good to have you here with us today. We are presented by our friends at French Lick Resort in French Lick, Indiana. We have two topics to talk about on today's show. Apologies for not doing a show yesterday. Had an unfortunate happening in our family. We had to put down our dog, Dottie. We had her for about 12 and a half years, and she was an incredible dog. And we kind of knew the time was coming, and last night it became very clear, well, the night before Monday night, it became very clear that it was time, and a very, very sad day for our family, but it just all happened very quickly, and just obviously very sad time for us, so just hence not doing a show yesterday, but back today, and I'll talk about Dottie on the 19th hole golf show a little bit later, because I had Dottie thanks to golf, thanks to being able to do this job for a living and being able to work from home for these last 12 years, almost 13 years. That's why we had her, and so it kind of brings it all back to golf for me in a weird way, but needless to say, we're going to miss Dottie a ton and love her very, very much. But on today's show, we do want to talk about some golf-related matters, and we want to start with what was just announced actually a little bit ago by the PGA Tour. They have announced what their fall schedule will look like for 2023 and beyond. They have reimagined the fall, and they had given us some sense of what that was going to look like at the Players' Championship. They didn't outline it all entirely there. So they came out today with the formal announcement of what that all is and what it all will mean. So let's outline it all and then offer a little bit of reaction to it. So there are going to be seven tournaments, official tournaments, in the fall that starts after the FedEx Cup season ends. And anyone can play in them. You do not have to be ranked at a certain point in the FedEx Cup standings to play in them or to not play in them, for example. I mean, a top player could agree to play in the Zozo Championship, for example, or the Sanderson Farms, or, I mean, name your tournament. They are not limited to play only the events of the FedEx Cup season. Now, I'm sure most of them will probably only play maybe once, if at all, but that's their choice. They have that opportunity. So they have seven events for the fall, and they will use these seven events to determine the top 125 players in combined FedEx Cup points from the regular season, the first FedEx Cup playoff event, and the remaining fall events. And those fall events will all offer 500 FedEx Cup points to the winner, just like they have previously. They will offer a two-year exemption to the winner, just as they have previously. They will offer opportunities to play in the Masters for those full field events, just as they have previously. All of that stuff will still apply to these new fall events. But the fall will be used to determine a bunch of different things, mainly around the top 125, the priority ranking, so in the order in which you finish in those FedEx Cup plus standings, basically, will determine how you get into any tournament next year. But the players who get into the top 50 are obviously going to get into every single designated event. Then the players 51 through 70 who qualify for the first FedEx Cup playoff event will get the additional bonus of whatever points they earn in that event tacked on to their point tally, so that by the time they get to the fall portion of the schedule, you really won't have to do a whole lot of work probably to be in good stead. Right? I mean, you're going to be exempt into every full field event next year, but you could also play your way through the fall to make some improvements on your priority order to get into these designated tournaments. So here are the benefits, and here's what's available throughout the fall per the PGA Tour. We talked about the winning benefits, so you still get that two-year exemption. If you win, you also get into the Century Tournament of Champions, which is the first designated event of the year. You also get into the players, and as we talked about, the majors, namely the Masters, that invites winners from full PGA Tour events. You still get into the PGA Championship as well, but you can also get in there by world ranking, which is a little bit, a deeper world ranking trait than the Masters. You also are fighting for priority ranking positions, we talked about. So the FedEx Cup fall, is what they're calling it, is going to crystallize the final priority ranking. The top 125 category will be crystallized for the players who weren't in the top 70. So they're going to take all the points from those tournaments and put it all together. And those players who finish 71st through 125th, they're going to be the ones who have that full status for next year. And they get into every regular event, not every designated event, but every full field regular event next year they're in. This will also determine entry into designated tournaments. So the 10 players who are not otherwise eligible with the most season-long FedEx Cup points through the fall. So that means regular season FedEx Cup, first FedEx Cup playoff event. I don't think that really applies to all of these folks, but yes. And then the fall events, all of those points combined, the best 10 who aren't otherwise in will get into the first two designated events that are not the Century Tournament of Champions. We don't know what those are yet because they haven't announced the 2024 schedule. Also, the players who were not previously eligible could use the FedEx Cup fall to get into the Players' Championship. If you're in that top 125, guess what? You're in the Players. You did it. So that's a big deal. And then the tour says there will be a total of $56.6 million in total prize money during the fall portion of the schedule. So that's a pretty big deal. Players ranked 51st and beyond will carry their FedEx Cup points from the regular season and the first playoff event into the FedEx Cup fall to try to accumulate more points. So I guess you could hypothetically fall out of the top 70. And I guess that's possible if you don't play the fall, but more or less you kind of want to be in that range. And I don't think there's a whole lot that can happen other than players just winning or finishing first and second a whole lot that could impact that dramatically. But it is worth noting that. Now, here are the events that are available to the players in the fall portion of the schedule this upcoming fall. The Fortinet Championship will start everything, take 2 weeks off, they're going to play the Ryder Cup in that time. Then there will be three in a row in October. The Sanderson Farms, the Shriners Children Open, and the Zozo Championship in Japan. So we talked about this a few weeks ago, wondering if the Zozo would try to move out of the fall or stay in the fall, how that was all going to work, because it may be truly an island unto itself playing in Japan that 1 week, or whether they were going to move the CJ Cup back to Korea, or how that was all going to work out. Well, here's our answer. Zozo's is going to be by itself in the fall, and it's going to be a fall event. So it's probably not going to get that many great players, but you probably still will get 9 or 10 top 50 players in the end, because that purse is still very sizable. Then they will take a week off. Then they will come back with the Worldwide Technology Championship that's moving to Cabo at Tiger's Design El Cardinal. That's replacing Mayakoba, because Mayakoba went to Live and the PGA Tour wasn't going to do any business with them anymore. Too bad, so sad. And then the final two events of the fall schedule are the Butterfield Bermuda Championship, which has evolved into a full-fledged 500-point event, and the RSM Classic will wind everything up here for the fall. So that's seven events. So there are two that were on the schedule last fall and one that hasn't been consistently for the last few years because of the pandemic that need to be addressed. And the PGA Tour talks about those. So the ones impacted that they have talked about here in this release include the Houston Open, which they say will be played now in the spring again, whether that's March or April or May, I guess TBD. Schedule will come out eventually on that, we'll know. But we kind of figured that out, right? I mean, there would be reports that Houston was interested in moving back and they would be willing to do what it took. Jim Crane, who's the guy that owns the Houston Astros, is worth a ton of money. So he's not really worried about flinging a couple extra million at it if that means getting on the better field and the better part of the schedule. The WGC HSBC Champions will not be played. Hasn't been played since 2019. Not going to be played again this year. And as already has been noted, the WGC Dell Technologies match play will also not be part of the the schedule in the 2024 portion of the FedEx Cup season. So that will be gone as well. What's not mentioned in this release is the CJ Cup. So the future of that, I guess, is still TBD. So beyond the FedEx Cup, getting into the top 125 at the end of the fall, there are going to be three other ways to get a PGA Tour card for next season. And that'll be the top 10, otherwise not exempt, in the Race to Dubai rankings on the DP World Tour, the top 30 players in the Korn Ferry Tour's points list. So the Korn Ferry Tour has moved away from having the joint finals with the bottom portion of the FedEx Cup regular season ranking and the best of the Korn Ferry Tour. Now it's 30 cards, all Korn Ferry Tour, no finals. The finals now are actually just elevated points structure events for their regular season, for their regular players. So that's their pathway. And then, as we talked about, the top five finishers and ties from the new PGA Tour Q School, the final stage, and that's back for the first time in 11 years this year. So there are three other ways to get into the PGA Tour as a player next year. And then there will be three challenge events other silly season events, challenge season, whatever they want to call them. We know them as silly season, but they are challenge season. And the three are what you would expect. The Hero World Challenge, the Grant Thornton Invitational, which used to be the QBE Shootout, is now going to be the mixed team event with the LPGA stars coming into play. And then the PNC Championship, which is the old father-son, but now is the family event on the schedule. So there are a couple of off weeks here to accommodate the Ryder Cup and travel around that, even though, frankly, if you're playing these events, you're not playing in the Ryder Cup. But that's what that will all look like. So it sounds like there's good incentive to play these tournaments. There's good value to them. There's good money. I mean, $56.6 million in prize money during the fall. Divide that up into seven events. 8 times 7 is 56. So you're looking at an average of an $8 million purse. That's nothing to sneeze at. I know it's not $20 million, but that's not nothing, especially for the players who are going to be playing a lot of these style events anyway. And it does seem to be a good way to wrap up the year while taking the regular season and making that matter, and then having an advantage for the better players who qualify for the first FedEx Cup playoff event, making it so that they're pretty much locked in stone. They're not going to fall very far in the ranking, even if they got hurt and didn't play well at all. They're okay. So you have a good reason to bring in guys who are on the cusp of designated events, or who had been in designated events but maybe had a rough year, and this is going to be in subsequent years too. So you got to start thinking about future years of this concept, not just this year, where you could be in most of the designated tournaments and then all of a sudden find yourself with a bad year in trouble. And not in trouble for your tour card, but needing to find a way to get into more designated events for next year in that turnover category. It could be interesting. And I don't know if guys in the future will just throw their hands up in the air and go, well, forget it, or they're going to fight for it. But I think this is kind of an interesting way of doing it. I don't think that there's really any better way of doing this, because it allows you to make the regular season mean something. It allows you to have the FedEx Cup brand name carry through the fall. Like, all these considerations that people who aren't in Ponte Vedra Beach don't have to think about, right? But they do, because they have FedEx cutting a huge check and they want their name on every week. So they didn't want a separate points list. They had to have some continuity. It couldn't be like the FedEx Cup part deux. It has to be its continuous thing. So that makes sense. It means the playoffs mean something. It gives an extra bonus to the people who qualify. It allows events to still have a character and meaning of offering a Masters invite. So if you aren't in the Masters and you're worried about your world ranking, there are ways in. You can win a tournament. That means something. So there's a lot at work here, I think, is good. And I think this is the best way they could have done it if they were going to try and build a new schedule. And frankly, this is kind of like the old way of doing things in many ways, where before the era of offering FedEx Cup points in the fall, you kind of just played the events to make money. And that
that was kind of bad. Now that they offer FedEx Cup points, it makes sense. But now that they're not doing it moving forward to get a head start, you're doing it to catch up. And I like the idea of having to catch up and having the opportunity to catch up so that guys who maybe had a bad regular year, they can get into the top 125 still. This is effectively a 7-tournament Q school for them to earn as many points as they can to come from out of that top 125. And for the players who are on that cusp, 110-ish, I don't know how much movement there's going to be, but players on that cusp can then, or are then forced to fight for their status. And I think we have created kind of a revision point here where, yeah, top 125 is great. That gives you entry into every full field event. But being top 70 is important, I think, in some respects. And maybe it gives you, especially if you're in that 51 through 70 range, if you're not already exempt and you get into the first two designated events based on your performance in the fall, you have some incentive to play. And you already have an advantage. So you have some incentive to finish there and make sure you finish there because of access to two $20 million tournaments right when the year kicks off is a great thing. So I think they pulled this together very, very well. I'm pretty happy with that. So we'll just kind of have to see what happens from there. But I think they did the right thing here. All right, second story for today. It's Masters related. Response from Patrick Cantlay to comments made by Brooks Koepka after the Masters, where he was talking about Cantlay's pace and not being happy with it, not being happy with the pace in general, really throwing at the feet of Cantlay, and I guess to a degree, Victor Hovland, who was playing in the final or the next to last group with Cantlay in the final round. And I mean, you could tell from TV that the pace was bad, right? I mean, if you watch the corner leaderboard, not the pace at which CBS was showing shots, because they did them kind of out of order in a weird pace, although the telecast was good. But if you look at how that all kind of looked in the last couple holes in particular, I'll say from 15 onward, you could see that the third or second to last group, I guess, third to last group, they were like a hole ahead the entire last three or four holes. And you saw the gap opening up between Cantlay and Hovland, and I think it was Henley in front. But anyway, you could tell that Brooks and John Rahm were not particularly happy. There was this one, I think it was a Getty photo that got circulated around on social, and it's those two guys standing on the tee box, like arms folded, looking pretty ticked off about the pace, and they just want to hit a shot already. And I don't know if that was directly in response to the pace of play they were experiencing, but I'm sure that it was, because Brooks made allusion to it, said that John Rahm went to the bathroom 7 times in the final round, and they still had to wait on every shot. And I think that was meant to say, look, these guys tried to do what they could to control their response to the poor pace of play, and it was still pretty bad. The final round was just under 4 hours and 50 minutes for the final group. That's pretty awful, frankly, for a two ball, especially a 2-tee two ball. That's just, it should have been closer to 4.5, maybe even 4:10. But I'll say 4.5. And that's, to me, that's 20 minutes too much. And that adds up shot after shot after shot. You just get annoyed. So Koepka's response, or Koepka's comment in particular, was, quote, "Yeah, the group in front of us was brutally slow. John went to the bathroom like 7 times during the round and we were still waiting," end quote. So yesterday, Patrick Cantlay, who's in the RBC Heritage, has a good tournament record, among the reasons why he would be coming into to the media center, he was asked about it and he offered his side of things and said, quote, "Yeah, I mean, we finished the first hole and the group in front of us was on the second tee when we walked up to the second tee and we waited all day on pretty much every shot. We waited in 15 fairway, we waited in 18 fairway. I imagine it was slow for everyone," end quote. That's not entirely accurate. I mean, you wait on 15 and you wait on 13 now, especially because the decision to go for it is a little bit different, right? I mean, you're hitting a longer iron in, which means you got to wait a little bit longer, I think, because you're going to get to your ball quicker because you're not hitting it, so you're not around the corner, and the likelihood of you going into the pine straw is a little bit different. So there's probably a smaller percentage of players who hit it up there and have to either choose to just kind of chip it down toward a layup number or whatever decision they want to make that's not going for it. And I'm sure some probably did, but most would not. So you've got 13 now as a decision hole where you're waiting. You've got 15 as the decision hole where you're waiting, and you're waiting farther back. That can add time. I understand that. Number two has not been lengthened. That's always kind of been a waiting hole because you're waiting for players to hit their fairway. You almost have to wait a little bit. Again, longer shots in, but everybody's still going for it. So you can't just stand there. You basically have to stand there and watch the group in front of you wait until they can hit, and then you go through the same process all day. So to a degree, Cantlay has a point, right? Eights like that too. They're all long enough that you're hitting a longer club in, but they're not so long that you can't go for it. So if you can go for it and you're trying to hit from 250 or 270 or an eight or two, a little bit longer, but on 13 to 15, you're still hitting it 200 to 230. I mean, you're still putting a good strike on it, but you can go for it. Those are going to pile up and four times around. So I can understand that point, but Patrick Cantlay is brutally slow. It is not fun to watch him play golf as a spectator. He's just so glacial in his pace. And apparently there were some shots on social media of Cantlay just being unbelievably slow. One of the ones that went around, I think, on social media was Hovland chipping from the other side of the creek on 13, and then Cantlay and his caddy were still 75 yards from the ball, and I think that wasn't particularly helpful. And then the two guys, Koepka and Rahm, waiting on 16 was the Getty Images shot or the screenshot or whatever, which wasn't great. So it's pace of play is brutal. I have advocated for a shot clock in golf. I think there should be a shot clock in golf. It's also a major championship, and there's a lot of prestige and history on the line. I can understand why players are reluctant to embrace that kind of thing. I have long advocated for a shot clock in golf and for more stringent application of the rules regarding pace of play. I understand this is a major. I understand there's history and a lot of money on the line, and that players need a little bit more leeway, perhaps. And in the grand scheme of things, I guess 20 minutes isn't that bad. But if you could get it to 4.5 or shorter without doing many things different other than asking people to hit a little bit quicker, it's a better TV experience. It's a better experience for the players. Everyone just comes out better, I think, in the end. And I would like to see, as much as I love the idea of rolling back the ball, I think pace of play matters even more to the product for TV, for golf fans, for people who are fans of professional golf at this level. So I don't know what can be done or what would be done. The PGA Tour has long been reluctant. I know this isn't a PGA Tour event, the Masters isn't, but the PGA Tour has long been reluctant to come up with a meaningful pace of play policy. They just like to kind of shine things up a little bit, make it look like they're doing something, but they're not doing anything. They don't do enough. They can do more. I would love to see, a shot clock follow every group around and reset every shot. It has worked wonders for baseball. It would do so much good for golf, I think. Whether that happens, that's a long way off. We've got a lot of fights here. A lot of fights to worry about here in golf. So maybe we'll come back to this in 2026, 2027, something like that. Unfortunately, it's going to be a while, I think. There's just too much walking and chewing gum at the same time to be done to really address this, I think, in a way that is meaningful and that people would like as fans and that the players could learn to live with. That's going to do it for us today on Two at the First. Thanks so much for your support of the show, of me, of Golf News Net. Last week was incredible. Great listenership through everything that we did on the audio side and website stuff was wonderful. But more importantly, thank you for your support of me and my family around Dottie. It does mean a lot. I mean, losing a member of your family, even a canine one, is a big deal. Hurts a lot. So Thank you for your support of that. If you do listen to us as a podcast, please give us a 5-star review on a platform. If you're listening to one that allows you to do that, leave a comment. Helps us reach more people. Shoot me a note, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Available on Twitter, Instagram as well. Ryan Ballingy is the handle there. Or Golf News Net, either is cool. We're happy to have you as a follower on either. We'll be back tomorrow with another show. It'll probably be later in the day. We're going to be traveling during the day, so it'll probably be a late afternoon edition of Two Off the First tomorrow, but we'll have one for you looking into everything around the first round of the RBC Heritage, and we'll have a round under our belts on the LPGA. They're starting today in Hawaii, Wednesday through Saturday. Lots to get to, I'm sure, and we'll be there with you for tomorrow's show. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time on Two Off the First.